Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight, as part of our series on criminal justice in the Bay Area, we focus on life after incarceration, or what's known as re-entry. The California Department of Corrections operates 3 adult women's prisons and 33 adult men's prisons throughout the state, incarcerating over 5,000 women and over 116,000 men. Despite a reduction in recidivism rates, an increased budget for rehabilitation, and a reduced prison population, recidivism rates still remain stubbornly high at nearly 50%. The formerly incarcerated still aren't eligible for many jobs and have barriers to housing, and their outcomes suggest that there's room for improvement. Should we be doing more to help them become productive citizens and good neighbors? Well, tonight we'll hear from 2 Bay Area residents who were formerly incarcerated. They are now involved in community organizations that assist in the reentry process. They speak from experience. I'm pleased to welcome in the studio Michael Mendoza, Policy Director at the Anti-Recidivism Project, or ARC. Michael was sent to adult prison as a juvenile and served 17 years behind bars. Since his release, he has gotten a BA in political science from San Francisco State University and worked in various policy reform efforts at Cut 50 and now at ARC. And he continues to mentor and educate currently incarcerated people. Welcome, Michael Mendoza.
Hi, thank you for having me here.
And we're also joined by Amika Mota, Program Director of Women's Prison Reentry and Policy at the Young Women's Freedom Center. Amika began organizing for reproductive justice and young mothers' rights over 20 years ago as a teenage mother and midwife. She began advocating for women in prison during her 7-year incarceration in the California Department of Corrections, where she served time at both the California Institute for Women and the Central California Women's Facility. Welcome, Amika.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in 20 minutes, we'll invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can dial 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. We'll open those phone lines up in about 20 minutes, but you can send your questions and comments for our panel at any time by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw.org. We want to hear from you. Have you or someone close to you been incarcerated? What was your reentry like? That's the number to call. It's 866-798-TALK. So, Michael Mendoza, let me start with you. What happens when you are released from prison? What is that first day and night like? Where do you go?
Good question. So, several things happen when somebody's released from state prison. In my experience, one, you're really trying to figure out what are you going to do next, right? There's all kinds of thoughts running through your mind from where am I going to live? Where am I going to work? Basically, how is this reentry system going to work for me? And as soon as you step out of gate, what you are going to be given is a $200 kind of a resource for you to use throughout your whole entire release process. Within 24 hours, you have to see your parole officer to make sure you check in. And at that point, your parole officer is really going to list or read to you a list of conditions that somebody who is on parole is going to follow. And it's basically a building relationship between you, your parole officer, as well as trying to also reestablish your relationships, whether they're with your family, with a program that you're going to report to. So the most important things for somebody who is reentering back into society and is going to be on some sort of supervision is to check in with your supervisor and to make sure that you have a place to stay and where you're going to work to obtain a sustainable living.
And Amika Mota, this is something I learned in preparation for the show that I didn't know, which is that most prisoners leave with debt. Can you describe what that is like, why that is the case?
Yeah, I actually don't know anyone that has paroled without debt, unfortunately. But yeah, we, you know, court fines and fees, restitution, those things are kind of assigned to us as we're convicted of a crime, and they follow us all the way through our reentry, and typically for years and years after reentering. So that's a system that's just set up the way it is, and that debt follows us. So we're definitely looking at that as a big burden that we wear out the door with financial strain as we leave. And like Michael said, what it's called gate money. It's $200 that we're given when we parole. And that's literally, in prep for this, I was running through what it looks like to buy a $60 bus ticket home, and then you're left with $140. And what's next, right?
So those prison jobs that many who are in prison are taking on, do they help pay down that debt?
The kitchen I worked for about 8 cents an hour, so I could, barely afford to buy the basic hygiene supplies that I needed inside prison and, any additional food supplies that we needed. Even at the best earning job I had in prison, I think I tapped out at about $56 a month. And so that was barely enough to take care of myself, let alone send money home for my family and my kids. Or build up any sort of savings or cushion for returning home.
And just to confirm, this debt is not the typical debt that the average American might have. This is debt related to the criminal justice process. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
And Meek, I wanted to stay with you on this. You heard Michael describe a little bit about that reentry process. Anything you wanted to add, what it was like for you when you were preparing for that day out and what that first day and night is like?
So there's that list that Michael talked about, right? Which and the list is something that we are running through the years leading up to when we come home. And then there's the emotion of rolling out of the gates of prison and maybe seeing a road and cars and trees for the first time in, from my experience, 7 years. Hugging your children, actually getting in a vehicle with your family, or taking a bus home to your family, or whatever it might be. But there's this emotional roller coaster that exists that is a really intense part of reentry too. So, along with all of the logistics that reentry that we need to sort through, there's this emotional roller coaster too of what it looks like to be coming home into the free world. And we've been confined and living in such a different environment for so long. So that's a huge piece of it too.
Well, and I also wonder, there's always a lot of technology changes that happen, and different types of cars driving around. I mean, does anything like that stand out to you? Yeah, to really be an indicator of the time passing.
The ride home with my kids and their cell phones and the Instagram and I think so. There was MySpace when I went in, and I came home to whatever else there is out there now. So and had no idea the smartphone and the I couldn't Google Docs or any of that stuff. It was all foreign, to definitely all of us that are doing longer stretches inside.
And Michael, I have to ask you the same question. I mean, you were incarcerated for many years, for 17 years. So you saw a lot of changes, suddenly. It's almost like being an anthropologist and coming out of space and seeing human society, or coming out of a coma or something. I mean, was it like that for you to see a whole different world?
Most definitely. I mean, for myself, the last time I was out in society prior to that was as a 13, 14, or 15-year-old kid. And now reentering back to society in my 30s, it was really difficult just to navigate from A to B, from home to work, from home to resource centers. And it's really an adjustment that takes a few months. It's not something instantaneous. It's something that takes a period of time with help. And with really resources that can help an individual kind of gain their footing and figure out how to get to the market, how to order food, and how to do the essential things in life that are just second nature to most experienced people.
And does the prison system have an orientation program? I mean, you mentioned an exit-type consultation, but, I mean, there's some basic just psychological reorientation, I would think, that some guidance on that, maybe talking to others who have been through it. Did you have support in that way?
Honestly, no. I think what you refer to maybe as like the pre-release kind of programming that somebody should go through. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of life skills that are taught prior to somebody's release. As we move forward technologically, even systematically, a lot of our systems out in society, we have a long ways to catch up in our prison systems to help people gain the footing they need and learn what to expect, learn how to navigate technology, especially with computers. I know my colleague Amica mentioned that we didn't even know what a Google Doc was. And so if we can't even prepare for the most simplest things that people out here communicate with, such as a Google Doc or an email, then we really lack the needs that are so essential out in today's societies nowadays. And so really there's nothing set in place to help people really prepare for the fundamentals that are necessary to survive out here.
And what about the role of family or friends, other loved ones? Are they typically there to meet those coming out of prison for that reentry process?
For those who do have families, yes. Unfortunately, not many do. For those who do, depending on how far away the prison is you're being released from, also plays a critical role. You have prisons that are in these desolate areas far away from the communities that you're going to be paroling to. And sometimes families can't make it. But when they do, we find that it's most helpful for people in their returning process.
And, Amika, let me ask you the same question around family. Is that also, I would imagine that's a big adjustment, too, to have to suddenly be back into a family that's kind of grown used to you not being there in that way. What is that adjustment like for people?
Oh, yeah. I think that was one of my biggest fears and what I knew what would be one of my biggest challenges in coming home is having been gone 7 years and known that, you know, I was gone from my children's life for that long. And yet I was coming home and I was going to be mom again. It wasn't just going to be, you know, I was coming into their living environment and somebody else's space that had cared for my children when I was gone. But I was going to have to be that role of mom again. And so I knew that there would be some struggle with that. I think that certainly the dynamic of getting, you know, having your family engaged and supportive and at those doors to pick you up really helps. Like, you know, Michael said, when I talk about my reentry and being picked up by my family, I feel extremely fortunate that I had that safety net of a family, you know, that was greeting me with open arms when I came home. But I would say the majority of folks returning home from prison do not have that support system.
And you do see family visitation hours, right? I would assume that's part of the process. How often do you see your family? Is that a way to at least try to keep up those bonds to some extent to help with the reentry?
Yeah, like Michael mentioned, a lot of prisons are placed in really remote locations. And so the first prison I was at was much too far for my family to travel to. So I didn't get to, I had one visit in the time I was there. And then, you know, I got to Chowchilla. It was a little bit closer to the bay. It was still about 2 to 3 hours for my family to get there, a big expense. And so definitely a few times a year I would see the kids. The last few years I was there, but that's not always the case either. It's just it's a stretch for families financially, and the time, you know, that it takes to get out to these locations can be really rough.
Well, so you're referencing your personal history, which is really helpful, and you know, I think a lot of listeners are curious, you know, your backstory. So how did you come to be an incarcerated person in the first place? What were the circumstances? And you mentioned you had kids at the time, so you can tell a little bit about what that was like.
So it was really, you know, it was a series of things in my life that it led to my incarceration. I definitely had experience with the criminal justice system as a young adult, as a juvenile, struggling with addiction for the majority of my life. And a series of events led me to this, you know, a sentence of 9 years and 8 months. And so I think that
How old were you at that time?
I was 29, 30 when I was sentenced.
And you had kids already?
I had kids, yeah. I had my son was 14. My youngest was 6. I had a 12-year-old as well. So, and I'd never been apart from them. It was like, I was mom. And so it was a really drastic, life-shattering thing for all of us when I was incarcerated.
And who took care of them while you were incarcerated?
They were shuffled around quite a bit. So friends for the first few years, and then the last, you know, chunk of time, the last 3 years of my incarceration, they were with my papa and his wife, and so that was the most steady, consistent home that they had. But they did a lot of, you know, being tossed around before then, but I didn't lose them to the system, which is another thing that happens often to folks that are doing kind of long-term sentences.
And so how long have you been out now?
I am about 4 years.
Right. And Michael Mendoza, same question for you. What were the circumstances of your incarceration? And, you know, talk a little bit about what that was like and, you know, your journey through that process.
So as a young Mexican-American growing up in Southern California, I experienced some traumatic events in my life at a very, very young age that I didn't know how to address or deal with. And so I found my way of trying to address these traumatic events through gangs. And unfortunately, at the young age of 15, I participated in a gang-related murder that unfortunately took the life of another young man, a life that shouldn't have been taken, a life that, you know, created a lot of harms in a ripple effect to a much more extended reach. And when I was incarcerated at that age, you know, being tried as an adult for me was a message from the rest of the world that basically said, you know, we give up on you. We don't have any hope for you, and so this is where you're going to spend the rest of your life in prison.
And you were 15 when this happened.
I was 15.
And they tried you as an adult.
Yes.
Is that pretty typical?
It is. It is. It was at that time. Now, again, this was in the mid-90s where it was the tough-on-crime stances where, you know, kids at that age were being called super predators. And so at that time, it was really, really common to try a kid who was under the age of 18, who committed a crime that was, you know, and then capable for an adult to do. So yes, in those circumstances, it was common. But you know, I think what I would say is that we now know that it does not help kids. It actually further harms them when we send them to an adult system that does not provide age-appropriate services. And so for me, being able to, in that situation where I was constantly being told that I was going to spend the rest of my life here, that became my mentality. It spiraled down into a hopeless abyss where I believed that I was going to spend the rest of my life in there. So those were the main circumstances at that point in time for me.
How long were you sentenced for originally?
A life sentence.
It was a life sentence.
Yes.
And so is it typical that you're out, you know, after 17 years? Is that often with good behavior or whatever the other factors are that people get out with 17 years?
Unfortunately, it's not typical. It takes people much longer than that. Fortunately, in my case, with smart policy that gave me an opportunity such as SB 260, it actually pointed California back in the right direction. Where prior to 1996, kids were not being tried as adults when they were 15 years or younger. And so that opportunity basically had California take into consideration the age and the hallmark features of youth when somebody commits a crime, such as immaturity, lack of impulse, and the capability to be able to grow into and mature.
And so SB 260 was legislation that passed after you were sentenced that allowed your young age to be taken into account for an early release. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And do you know when that legislation passed?
2013.
So that gave you a whole new lease on life.
It did. It actually gave me a different message from society saying that we do believe in you. We understand that you were really young at that age, and we want to give you the opportunity to be able to prove that you are no longer that 15-year-old kid again.
And you mentioned that you got caught up in gangs at a young age. I mean, was it the kind of neighborhood where there weren't a lot of other options, or was it just, as you said, kind of your personal circumstances that made you open to joining one?
Both. Both. I'd say that there were several different circumstances that led to me making those really bad choices as a young kid, especially my immaturity and lack of foresight, you know, not really appreciating the consequences to my decisions.
And does gang activity still continue on in prison? I do hear stories sometimes that, you know, you have to divide prison populations by, you know, gang affiliations. Is that still a pressure even once you're in the system?
It is definitely a pressure. And I think what it points towards is the conditions that our prison environments kind of set. You know, it's really difficult for somebody who isn't treated as a human being, go through circumstances where they feel less than human, whether that's because they're being strip searched on a constant basis or just the whole system itself is really difficult for people to kind of find their way towards a more successful approach.
Well, you mentioned SB 260 as being one of the critical factors for you. What other factors were important to you to help enable your ability to be so successful coming out of prison now?
I would say that family reunification was very, very important. I was very fortunate to still have a mother and father who would attempt to visit me at least four times a year, who would write to me every time they would get a chance to. And for me, that kept a dimmer of hope that somebody out in society still cared about me and still wanted me to be successful. So for me, I would say that it's important where we still feel that outside connection to give you and inspire hope in you.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, as part of our series on criminal justice in the Bay Area, we're talking about the challenges of reentry for formerly incarcerated people, and we're speaking with Michael Mendoza, Policy Director at the Anti-Recidivism Project, or ARC, who was incarcerated for 17 years, and Amika Mota, Program Director of Women's Prison Reentry and Policy at the Young Women's Freedom Center, who was incarcerated for 7 years. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. Do you have experience working with incarcerated or formerly incarcerated people? Do you have ideas as to how reentry should go? You can join this conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And we're also on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, Amika Mota, let me ask you the same questions that I was asking Michael before that break, which is, what was the formula for you? What were the factors that helped you be successful coming out of prison?
I think that, you know, the time that I served on the inside, I definitely spent a lot of that time in preparation for coming home. And so definitely kind of getting spiritually and mentally strong again and getting grounded and centered in who I was before I was incarcerated and, the series of events that led me down that road. Reentry, family was huge. I am so incredibly grateful that I had, a roof over my head. I didn't have to think about where I was going to sleep. I had support. That was huge. And the other thing that was really transformative in my specific reentry story is that I was swooped up by a community-based organization about 6 months after my reentry. And so that made all the difference for me.
And this organization was?
The Young Women's Freedom Center in San Francisco. So local organization. We've been around for about 25 years and run by 95% formerly incarcerated women.
And what was it that this organization was able to do that was so helpful for you?
Well, just the 6 months before I connected with the Young Women's Freedom Center was the struggle of logistics and how do I get on my feet? How do I find a job? I was getting turned down by Amazon and Starbucks and like jobs that felt really like I should be able to get a basic entry level job.
And do you feel like that was because of your criminal record?
You know, I didn't know at the time. I mean, it's hard to say that that is the only factor, but I felt competent to be able to do those jobs. And so I think that definitely I felt like those things played into why I wasn't getting employment. And a lot of that time, you're figuring out how to explain your, the time you've been gone and your downtime and your incarceration to a prospective employer. And the difference between the Young Women's Freedom Center, which is this organization that was one of my first jobs, was that rather than something that I had to hide, it was an asset to the organization. And because it was this, purpose that I had to serve in this organization was to reach back for other currently incarcerated and formerly incarcerated folks in reentry. And so that was pivotal for me. It just changed the whole path my life was on.
So let's go to the phone lines. We have Ariane calling in from San Francisco. Ariane, welcome to City Visions.
Yes, hello. I did my academic research on prisoner reentry, and I just have a few comments to make. And, of course, I'm not comparing myself to the two wonderful people who've had personal experience. I just want to remark that in this culture, we have trouble separating crime and punishment, and we need to really reconsider that addiction is a public health problem and that people who've been traumatized and who've been disrespected, perhaps because they're indigent people of color, and who lack a sense of belonging and a sense of self-respect or meaning, that all those things are what are needing to be addressed. There needs to be a sense of belonging, which gangs can provide, or something else could provide. Maybe we could have city centers where we understand family and community in a totally different way. And of course, they need to be liberally financed. And in terms of meaning, we need to restore the sense of self-purpose that everyone needs to have to feel like their life is worthy of living. And when we define people's value by their income or by their jobs, that's not the full thing. We have to have a much larger understanding of that. And we have to understand that we have a double standard. There's a two-tiered prison system, one for the wealthy and one for indigent people and people of color. And you can just see it with the opiate crisis, how it's being handled.
Yeah, well, Ariane, I think these are really useful comments, and I would love to get an opportunity for one of our panelists to respond. So, Michael, I'm starting with you. Do you have thoughts in response to what Ariane has mentioned in terms of needs going forward?
Yeah, thank you for the comments, Ariane. I definitely agree. I think our prison system is still built off of the punishment and retribution model, and really struggles to provide people with the life skills necessary that will help them address whether it's addiction, whether it's the lack of skills to gain employment. There's definitely programs such as Young Women's Freedom Center and the Anti-Recidivism Coalition that I believe are small windows into these worlds where if a perfect world would exist, it would be such as these programs, because these programs, one, do not hold any kind of criminal convictions against you. They provide opportunities. They welcome you with open arms. They're very, very inclusive rather than exclusive. And I point those things out because for anybody who wants to face their addiction, their whatever it may be, the environment that they are going to be in is really critical in how it encourages them and empowers them to overcome the inner obstacles as well as the outer obstacles. So we definitely need more organizations that can address these issues in a healthy way.
All right. And Amika, any comments in response to Ariane's comments from her dissertation research?
No, I do appreciate your comments, Ariane. I think that, one of the things that you mentioned, are kind of systemic problems that that are not touched on when a crime is committed and a punishment is handed down. And, I think that a lot of folks entering the prison system are dealing with poverty, addiction. There is a trail of things that we come into prison with and we leave with those things. And so there are systemic issues that need to be addressed, and also connection. We know that connection is like the root of success. And so these community organizations that we both have mentioned, and just being welcomed home by the rest of society, I think is really, really crucial.
All right. Well, thank you, Ariane, for that question. And Amika, I have to ask you one other question around your time in prison. Mm-hmm. What activities did you engage in? It sounds like, just reading about your background, you were very entrepreneurial there. Can you describe some of the activities and those that specifically were helpful for you on the reentry part of the process?
Yeah, I think that, beyond getting over my initial shock of the 9-year, 8-month sentence and adjusting to prison life, I'd say after maybe year two, I never wasted a moment in prison. And that was, by reading hundreds of books, I feel like I was in charge of my own rehabilitation inside prison. It was not handed to us. It was not really well supported by state-run programs. Getting really fit physically was really crucial to me, staying really engaged in something that wasn't beyond what was happening inside those prison walls, which was getting myself ready. I was also a firefighter inside, so that was really huge.
So firefighting in the prison, any fires are breaking out in the prison?
No, within a 30-mile radius of the state prison. So we actually had a mutual aid agreement with Madera County, and we responded in the community.
So you would get out to be able to fight a fire?
We did. For the last 2.5 years I was incarcerated, I fought fires in the community.
And any other activities that you want to mention that were useful?
Paralegal training. We worked on our cases. We spent a lot of time in the law library. And we, as women, we created space for love and family on the inside. We cooked together as best we could. We, you know, we shared experiences together, and yeah.
All right. Well, this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, as part of our series on criminal justice in the Bay Area, we're talking about the challenges of reentry for those who are incarcerated and now being set free. So we're speaking with Michael Mendoza, who's the policy director at the Anti-Recidivism Project, or ARC. He was incarcerated for 17 years. And Amika Mota, program director of Women's Prison Reentry and Policy at the Young Women's Freedom Center, incarcerated for 7 years. And we invite you to call in with questions or comments. Do you feel like we have too many barriers in place for the formerly incarcerated? Or do you think they're already at appropriate levels? Are you concerned about an uptick in crime if we do start to remove barriers? You can join this conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can send your questions or comments. Also by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can also post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or our Facebook page. And we're on Twitter at CityVisionsKALW. Well, let's go to the phone lines. We have a caller from Oakland. Tom, you are on the air. Welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. And thanks to both of your guests for sharing their stories. And I wish them good luck in their new lives. What do you guys think it would take in terms of programs and dollars to help people coming out of prison readjust better? And what do you think would be the difference in recidivism rates if your suggestions were to come to pass?
All right, Tom, it's a good question. So, Michael, let me start with you on that question. Where would you want to spend the resources, and what do you think impact it would make?
So I would start by actually looking at the current program that we do have, and I'll just use an example of the vocational trades that we offer within our prison systems. They are great as a starting point, but what they lack is actually transitioning that training into jobs when somebody comes home. So somebody can take a vocational trade and learn how to be a plumber. But in all actuality, once that individual returns back to society, there's a gap, whether they earned the education 2 years or 1 year prior to release, there's still a gap where they have to kind of update their education upon release. And then there's the issue of actually finding a job within that vocational trade, which can be very, very difficult with the criminal background you have. So I think the important part of how we can help individuals with their training or with their educational careers while they're inside is establish that pathway into an actual job opportunity. I think that would go a long ways in terms of, you know, helping people to get a vocational trade while they're incarcerated, but then making sure that that trade turns into an actual job upon release. That's where the disconnect currently is right now, and the struggle is where somebody who has actual educational experience but has the trouble to actually gaining the career within their experience. And then what ends up happening is that they have to find a job outside of what they've learned, and usually that experience is less than what they already have. So I think making sure that we can improve the vocation to job pathway is critically important.
So I guess you're buried in that answer is the assumption that it's the job issue that is the biggest contributor to recidivism, the high recidivism rate. Is that accurate to say based on
yes,
what you said?
Yes, that's correct. That's accurate to say. I think the biggest struggle is finding an employer who will trust and give somebody the opportunity with a criminal conviction.
And Amika, let me turn that question from Tom over to you.
Sure.
How would you spend the money? Where would you invest the resources to try to reduce the recidivism rates?
Yeah, I think that I would really work on the preparation for reentry beginning inside of the prisons. And I think that, you know, as when I paroled, I was given my, you know, a month before I paroled, a list of resources. The majority of those resources were state-funded resources. I do wish that I had engaged in programming with the community that I was going to parole into before I came home. I do wish that I had formerly incarcerated folks coming inside and navigating me through that process as somebody that's been through it, not a parole officer sitting in an office handing me a list of resources. I wish that I truly had somebody that would invested in me and understood what it was like and could kind of walk me through that process. I think that jobs are a huge issue and housing is a crisis. I mean, in the Bay Area, paroling home is insane. So housing is certainly an issue. I think we really need to expand on the programs that are available for folks returning home, especially women with children. You know, we have a couple amazing programs, and you know, a Time for Change Foundation in Hayward, Kim Carter, some really wonderful models to work off of that don't have the massive, you know, amount of money that the state has, right? Because there's certainly state-run programs as well that look very different. And so I think that there is, you know, there needs to really be a collaboration between community and state as folks are preparing to release, you know, men and women back into their communities, that the bridge needs to be gapped. You know.
All right. Well, that's some helpful insight for Tom. Thank you for that question. And I have to ask both of you, you both experienced prisons from different genders, so women's prison, men's prison, and I'm guessing there are some pretty significant differences. Like, for example, Mika, you talked about women cooking together. It's not the stereotypical image of a men's prison. And Michael, I'm just curious
We cook together.
They totally cook together, we'd have some showdowns. I mean, I'm
a really good cook.
All right. So you're shattering stereotypes here. So, Michael, what are your perceptions of the differences between a men's and women's prison?
At least for men in men's prisons, it's very, you can see the testosterone, if you will, throughout the whole entire prison system. From whether it's, you know, on the prison yard, and how it can be very segregated because of, you know, the differences between whether it's gangs, whether it's cultures, or whether it's even between the people who are currently incarcerated and correctional officers. I think for a man doing time in prison, there's always that sense of pride, the really difficult time to not be in touch with your emotions and be more in touch with your persona, I think takes a huge role within the male prison system in a bad way. At the same time, men aren't used to talking about their feelings. Men aren't used to being able to cry with another man, and I think that really hurts us men who are finding themselves incarcerated, because it doesn't allow you to really do that inside work, to really build those strong communications that you should, especially for somebody who needs to get in touch with their emotional side and make sure that, you know, they are able to see how it is to feel emotion. You know, sometimes people who end up in those situations really have hardened themselves, and they continue to harden themselves as they continue to do their time. So I think that's one of the stigmas and the downsides to those kind of situations.
And knowing that was a challenge that you saw, are there things you would recommend that could be done to reform prisons to address this deficit?
Yes, I definitely recommend more programs that allow people to break down their masculinity, to really, you know, look at themselves in a way that can, you know, break down those emotions, figure out where those emotions come from, figure out how, you know, as a man you're taught to grow up in a way that's really hurtful to the rest of society and also to women as well. And so any kind of program that can really help men figure out the emotional side and how to, you know, talk about those things would definitely go a long way.
And you did cook.
Did cook.
And there was group cooking, men getting together to cook.
I'll share with you one of my favorite recipes.
All right. It's too bad it's a radio and not in person, so we can't share with listeners. So, Amika, question to you then. What are your perceptions of the differences between a men and women's prison?
Yeah, I think it's definitely different environments. We definitely have a sense of pride that we carry in there as well, a sense of needing to prove ourselves and protect ourselves on the yard. You know, I think that one of the standouts for me about women's prisons is, you know, about 80% of us are mothers. About 80% of us have also experienced sexual abuse coming into prison. And prison continues to traumatize us in this area. So there is definitely things that we're subject to in prison as women that is really unique. And, you know, some really, really deep systemic issues that need to be touched on there. But I think that the resilience of women is just absolutely amazing and powerful and overwhelming. And I think that folks, you know, that maybe had no sense of prison but came to a woman's yard would be pretty blown away by what we do with so little. So this brilliance and creativity and a sense of family that we create amongst each other to survive these intense, oppressive, depressing conditions, that is outstanding. I mean, it's beautiful. It's a very beautiful thing to see what people do to survive these environments. So there's always these beautiful pieces that I carry with me about what it looks like to live in prison with women. And there's also these horrific experiences.
Within the system itself.
Within the system itself.
That shouldn't be happening?
Or that shouldn't just be happening, that aren't being talked about, that aren't being brought to the forefront of the issues today. And then just navigating dynamics is rough, too. You know, we're not flowing with testosterone, but there's a different posture we take on the prison yards, you know, and we do because we have to protect ourselves and we have to prove that we're capable of taking care of ourselves.
And are these infractions happen between or among the prisoners or from the staff?
Both.
To the prisoners?
Both. Absolutely both.
And what needs to be done to try to address these experiences that shouldn't be happening?
I think that one of the, you know, the issues that we're definitely working on at the Young Women's Freedom Center in coalition with the California Coalition for Women's Prisoners is really talking about the Me Too movement behind bars and what it looks like to deal with sexual assault on prison yards and harassment. And so, you know, as a formerly incarcerated, there's plenty of people that have been working on this from, you know, legal coalitions and people doing amazing work. But as a formerly incarcerated person working with other women on this now, we know that part of this is storytelling and coming together and sharing our stories and figuring out what it is that we do because we know the solutions lie with us.
Well, it's similar to outside of prison as well. We need these stories to be told. Yep. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and we're streaming live on the web at KALW.org. Tonight you're listening to part of our series on criminal justice in the Bay Area, and we're talking about the challenges of reentry for those who are incarcerated and now free. And we're speaking with Michael Mendoza, Policy Director at the Anti-Recidivism Project, or ARC, incarcerated for 17 years here in California, and Amika Mota, Program Director of Women's Prison Reentry and Policy at the Young Women's Freedom Center, who was incarcerated for 7 years. And we invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The number to join is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment on our website at kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And we're also on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, Amika, staying with you on this question of women and the fact that many of these women, as you mentioned, have children. Mm-hmm. So what happens typically when they're released? Do they immediately get custody back of their children, or are there, you know, processes that have to be undertaken for that to happen?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a process. It's nothing immediate. You know, there's a number of things that we typically have to do to get custody back, and one of those is show that we have stability in the form of housing, in the form of employment. And, you know, reentry is not, it's not an overnight, we don't get back on our feet overnight. It's a process of years of building. You know, because we get a job at, you know, a minimum wage job, or we have somewhere to sleep, does not mean that we've sustained or that, you know, that we're economically stable. And so folks are definitely dealing with these issues. Women are definitely having to, you know, kind of prove themselves in court that they're capable of taking care of their children, but up and against, you know, a system that is just not really supporting us with housing and employment. But it's not overnight. It took me, even with housing and a job, it took me, I think, 6 months before the conversation could even, like, take place about me trying to get custody of my children back. And it was about a year.
It took a year.
I was living with them, but I did not have legal custody of them.
So most women who are freed are able to live with their children, but they all face a situation of having to get legal custody, or is it?
It just depends on what the situation is that has existed. You know, some people don't have the ability to live with their children when they come home. Some people have lost their children to the system, and they're up against that battle rather than just a family situation. And so it looks really, really different for everybody.
We have another caller with a question. K.I. dialing in. K.I., welcome. City Visions. K.I., are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I just want to acknowledge and thank both our folks who are in the interview. And I just wanted to ask, is there any uplifting words you could share with, like, our folks who are in the movement doing the work? And what keeps y'all motivated and grounded and continue to fight for change for our folks?
All right. Well, thank you, K.I., for that question. Let me direct that one to Amika.
Hey, K.I. Well, I just have this big smile on my face because I think that your call just, you know what, words of inspiration for me is this incredible sisterhood that that we have in community with each other. The network of folks that have endured like these crazy things in their life, and that have navigated systems that were designed to set us up to fail, we're able to come together in community and sisterhood and siblinghood and build up power together. I think that the any inspiring words I would have would just be that that we're not broken. That we are completely capable of rising up to who we know we are, and that all of these solutions to this criminal justice reform and fix and designing new systems that we know that work for our children and our children's children lie within the hearts of the men and women that have endured the impacts of incarceration.
And Michael, inspiring words that you can offer?
I mean,
no pressure.
Yeah, I don't know how I can follow up with that. But, you know, I would say that our population is just so used to having to prove to the rest of the world that we are capable of success, that we are human beings. And when I see my colleagues and my brothers and sisters like Amika and so many others who just continue day in and day out despite the confrontations we come up against, or despite the barriers we face, we still push. And I think we don't just push for ourselves. We don't just push for the people that we left behind, but we push for our families, and we push ultimately for our communities and what we want to see in the long-term goals. So I just really am excited to continue to work with folks such as Amika and others. And we just say, you know, we have to keep pushing.
That's right. And I also just have to say, too, that I think that part of what our role is in this movement now is not forgetting the ones that we've left inside, and that we are out here fighting for folks like Michael, who never thought he may see the light of day again, you know, or folks that never thought they would be reunited with their children, and that we are out here paving the way for the folks that are going to come home behind us.
And Michael, we mentioned that you work for ARC. Can you describe a bit about what that organization does and your role in it?
Yeah, so we do. I like to say that the Anti-Recidivism Coalition does two things. One, we provide direct services to those who are formerly incarcerated. And we offer a platform for people to advocate. Our direct services consist of housing, in-reach through programs such as the Hope and Redemption. We provide training through at the Ventura Training Center, where people who want to become firefighters can also delve in that kind of training. And we also provide a platform for people who are formerly incarcerated to advocate for change, not only by using their stories or their personal experiences, but also by, you know, sharing what a better world would look like, both inside of incarceration and outside. And it's an opportunity for people who are formerly incarcerated to lift up their voices, to talk to people who they may never have spoken to before. And I think those two things are important for people who are coming home, because it gives them the opportunity to not only professionally develop and find homes, find jobs, but also to find their voices and to get the opportunity to express their voices, because you'd be surprised how talented and how smart and how educated people are who have spent time in prison. They just need the opportunity.
And how did you get involved in the Anti-Recidivism Coalition?
Interesting question. I mentioned earlier that SB 260 was passed in 2013, and mostly in part due to several great individual peoples that I can't go on without mentioning. One of them is Elizabeth Calvin of the Human Rights Watch, in partnership with the Anti-Recidivism Coalition, who really were the spearheads, along with other great partners, to pass SB 260. And that's how I first got involved. I was one of the first individuals who directly benefited from that bill. And since then, when I came home in 2014, I started as a member advocate, and just poured my heart and soul into the work. And now I'm fortunate enough to be the policy director, where I can examine and look at the bills and policies that could either hurt or help our population. And so it's important to realize and make sure that what we do advocate for now doesn't just quickly address a short-term problem, but points to long-term goals and solutions that we want to envision for a better community.
And I have to ask how the organization got started.
It was started in 2013 by a great friend of mine, Scott Budnick. He's really well known for producing the Hangover movies. He was introduced into a juvenile hall where he saw the injustices being incurred upon really young kids who were receiving adult life sentences, and just had to stop what he was doing to address those injustices. And he brought people together, whether they were formerly incarcerated or people who wanted to make change. He built something that grew into something even more special, and that is now being led and given over to people who are formerly incarcerated to continue to carry that path.
So it's a whole interesting origin story just by itself, but great to hear that so much good work is happening out of his passion for this issue and for getting folks like you to work with him on this effort. And Amika, I wanted to ask you about your organization, a Young Women's Freedom Center. Can you describe a bit about what that organization does and how you got involved in it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the quick version of what kind of organization we are is a leadership and advocacy organization. And there are a lot of moving pieces at the center. We have a research institute that is training up folks that are directly impacted to conduct research in the community, so that we have our own data to kind of back up what we're doing. We have internship programs. We have, allow folks to kind of step into their own selves in advocacy roles. And so when folks connect to particular policies that are happening, we definitely work on analysis of our whole story before we get up and storytell. And so we kind of go really deep into that. And we're a network of, we're building out the Sister Warriors Coalition, a statewide network of formerly incarcerated women that are coming together and doing just that, fleshing out what we want to see, happen policy-wise, and taking the reins in leading the advocacy behind those policies.
And you mentioned a little bit earlier how you got involved, but can you just describe how that all came together for
you?
Yeah,
I actually met our current ex-executive director, Jessica Nowlin, at an event, and she said, you should just come by and check out the center. I think you might, you might fit in well here.
And this is after you were out.
This is after I was out and, kind of running in these circles of trying to, mask this experience I'd just been through. And I recognized Jessica in the room. She was one of my folks. There was just that energy. And so, I came into the center, had an interview, started an internship there, and, eventually worked to where I am right now, which is Prison Reentry and Policy Director.
And so, speaking of policy, are there particular policies that you're involved in right now that you're trying to see put in place, legislation, reforms?
Yeah,
what are
definitely.
You working on now?
So the center has been working on SB 42, which addresses late night releases, which is a beautiful picture of kind of what it looks like to lead advocacy from the ground. And so one of our sisters was released from Santa Rita Jail, late night release, and was found dead at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it's a 2-mile walk to the BART station. There's no transportation provided. There's no cell phone charging station provided at Santa Rita. And so we knew as formerly incarcerated folks that this is an issue that has existed for a long time that has never been addressed. And so when this happened with Jessica St. Louis, we immediately mobilized, and Skinner authored this bill. Her office has been
Nancy
amazing.
Skinner,
Nancy
State
Skinner,
Senator.
Yes. And so that was just kind of one of those beautiful things of like what we see happening on the ground, and you know, seizing that moment and running with a policy we know should have happened. We're also working on SB 555, which addresses the cost of phone calls and electronic communications in the county jails, which we know is a huge burden for women in particular that carry the brunt of this financial impact of incarceration.
And Michael, same question for you. Are there any particular reform efforts, legislation, things you're working to change?
Yes, I'd have to briefly mention two. One of them would be Assembly Constitutional Amendment 6, which would pose a question to our voters in 2020 whether or not somebody on parole with a felony conviction should have the right to vote. Obviously, we believe yes. For many important reasons, as we establish reentry and get more into reentry, we want reentry to be more inclusive. We believe that disenfranchisement obviously was a bad choice, and so to include people in our democratic process would be more inclusive, would be more engaging, would be more pro-social, and would hopefully help people reduce the recidivism rates.
So right now, those who are convicted of a felony cannot vote in California.
That's correct.
So it's similar to Florida, but you'll hear more about the dynamic in Florida than you do in California.
You do, yes. Similar to Florida. However, when somebody does get off parole, then they are able to vote. But we want to focus more on the immediate years that somebody's being released, because that's the time where they're most vulnerable. And I would also have to just briefly mention SB 394. It's authored by Senator Skinner as well. And it's a pretrial caregiver diversion program. Mainly targeting primary caretakers who, upon arrest, and just to basically say that it would give them the opportunity to address their needs, and if they would be able to address their needs through a diversion program, then they would avoid incarceration and it would keep families together. It was just the most important thing. We have so many families that are separated because of incarceration. We believe this bill would keep families together and address that.
We only have about a minute left here, but besides this legislation, for those who want to get involved, want to help, are there any particular organizations, obviously yours, that you work for, anything else that people should consider supporting? Amika?
For anybody that wants to support the Sister Warriors Freedom Coalition across the state of California, formerly incarcerated folks make up the coalition, but we welcome allies to join and support. There are many different ways you can support, and you can find us at youngwomenfree.org.
And Michael, same question.
There are so many great partner organizations that we have both collaborate with, along with, you know, Young Women's Freedom Center and the Anti-Recidivism Coalition. There's just so many. Initiate Justice, Youth Justice Coalition. So many that I would love to give a shout out to. Cut 50, great partner of ours. Just look up at the websites and you'll see the great work that they're all doing.
That's all right. Great. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Michael Mendoza, Policy Director at the Anti-Recidivism Project, or ARC, who was incarcerated for 17 years. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Amika Mota, Program Director of Women's Prison Reentry and Policy at the Young Women's Freedom Center. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was Damian D. Miner. And tonight's show is produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us again next week when my co-host Joseph Pache explores the new age of space exploration in America. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.
I'm Kerry Fremkin. Join me at the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival for two beautiful examples of late 19th century chamber music. The Terzetto in C major, opus 74,
gave new life to the undead.